You're listening to Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Hello, welcome to A Slice of Cheese, the Food FM radio series that celebrates the world of cheese. I'm Jenny Linford, a food writer and cheese enthusiast, the author of Great British Cheeses. Cheese is a delicious and fascinating food, and we're setting out to explore this remarkable food and share the stories of the people who make, sell and love it. For centuries, farms were the places where cheese was made, transforming precious, perishable milk into food which could be stored and sold. We talked to British farmer and Cheshire cheesemaker Sarah Appleby of Hawkstone Abbey Farm and American farmer and cheesemaker Andy Hatch of the Uplands Cheese Company in Wisconsin about the rewards and the challenges of farmhouse cheesemaking.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, very happy to have with me today Sarah Appleby of Appleby's Dairy. Good morning, Sarah.
Hi, Jenny.
Sarah, I very much wanted you on this episode because we're looking at the idea of farmhouse cheese. Appleby's leapt to mind, and you are very famous for a cheese that you make on your farm. Perhaps you could tell us what that is and give us a little bit of the history behind that cheese.
Oh, thanks, Jenny. Yeah, so we have been farming here for three generations, and the cheese that we make because we live in this place is Cheshire, which I think is really fascinating. So it's something that is inherited, but inherited from way, way, way further back than those three generations. Three generations in cheesemaking is a nanosecond in a way. When you're talking about one of those foods that's been around for millennia. So, but what fascinates me is that obviously the Cheshire is Cheshire because of the area, and because when my husband Paul's grandparents moved here in the late 1940s, moved their cows here, and grandma came from a line of female cheesemakers, because I think last time I spoke to you, we were talking about women in cheesemaking.
We were, yes.
So grandma, yeah, which is, again, really fascinating. And so grandma, she, of course, made Cheshire. She started in 1952 here in the dairy that is right next to our kitchen. She started 1952 and she had seven children and wheeled the pram between the kitchen and the dairy, and you know, and thus it is still now, because my husband Paul is cheesemaker, and you know, it's lovely that it's still such a part of family life. So yeah, that's where we're at, and Cheshire is something that sounds, you know, that we slightly fell into, but we didn't fall into it. That Cheshire was made here because of many reasons. One being obviously the minerality. I can't say that, Jenny.
Minerality.
The soil's
richness. Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, it's a beautiful cheese, your Cheshire cheese. It really is a joy. And it's a very, you know, a famous traditional cheese, you know, with this long history of being made and eaten. It, you know, for a long time, it was the sort of best-selling cheese in Britain. But so today we're looking at this idea of farmhouse cheese. And of course, you know, farms with cows was where cheese was made, you know, historically. This is very ancient. And the fact that it's still, this practice carries on today, you know, is something to be welcomed, I think, and embraced. And I wanted to sort of get into that story. So as you've got a herd of dairy cattle, they're on your land. What are the things that you're doing with the land? Perhaps you could tell us about, and in fact, actually, that's very relevant to the Cheshire story, the idea. Tell us about that, about the salinity in the soil and how that expresses itself through the milk.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, one of the fascinating things about the terroir, isn't it? The why the British territorial cheeses are as they are, you know, they're obviously of an area, so of a territory. So Cheshire, yeah, so when grandma and grandpa moved here and walked the cows, and very much that symbiotic relationship between the farming and the cheese making was very strong. in those days. And I think when there were, at the turn of the century, about 2,000 Cheshire cheesemakers, because you're absolutely right, it was the cheese that fed the nation at the turn of the century. What's so interesting is that those 2,000 Cheshire cheesemakers here were very small herds, but they had the cows. They didn't buy in the milk. The milk was obviously produced, and the surplus milk was made into cheese as a way of feeding people and prolonging the life of milk, which obviously is has a short shelf life, we'd call it nowadays. But, you know, that's really fascinating. And as Grandpa farmed and grew the farm, grew and he had more cows, it was still very important, that relationship. And looking back at Grandma's make books, in those books from 1952, she talks about the paddocks that the cows were grazing and, you know, maybe they had dandelions on. And, you know, that relationship between the farming, so the land, the grass, the cows, the type of cow, where they were grazing that day, what the weather was like. I just think that is one of the hugely wonderful things of territorial cheeses, that real long connection of the milk story, which I really love. And when we're tasting cheese, we've just tasted this morning, Paul and I and Tom, our cheesemaker, the cheese, the discussions that we have, I think, you know, would be similar to those ones back in, you know, 1926, when the cheeses, I think something like 120 tons went from Whitchurch Market on the Christmas cheese train. And those wonderful photos of the chaps with the big moustaches that were grading, which I'm not massively keen on that word, but were tasting and selecting cheeses. Then I think they would have known those farmers, the names of the families that were making the cheeses. And I don't know, I think it's what for me makes it so interesting. And the relationship with the farm has been something that Paul and I have worked really hard to develop, because it was definitely so with Grandma and Grandpa. And then we you know, the farming that we did, I think, would be, you would probably have heard this before, that it definitely went more for yield, and, you know, more farmers had Holstein Friesians, and that's when a lot of these Cheshire farms, you know, the demise of Cheshire cheese was a bit in part with that, because liquid milk became more valuable. And, you know, we were changing our relationship with the cows. And actually, Paul and I very strongly, about 5 years ago, decided that the farm was sort of going in a way that we weren't feeling that the relationship with the cheese wasn't so close. It was becoming a bit more tenuous. So we now, all the cows, you know, go out to graze as soon as possible. You know, they went out early March, which is right. The cheese we were tasting this morning, which was fascinating. Those conversations about, oh, wow, gosh, you can tell the butterfat protein has changed. And one cheese was really dandelion-y, that the, you know, the grassiness was really apparent. So
that's interesting. Yeah. So you've decided in a way to sort of, I don't know, make stronger what the connection between this is a farm that makes cheese, and so that the milk is for cheese making. I mean, I know this is something that often I discuss in this program, what makes good milk for cheese making. Is that one of your missions then, with, you know, when you talked about trying to redress the balance on the farm?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Because I think for the territorial cheeses like ours, that, you know, we do talk about the salinity, obviously the saltiness came from this area around Cheshire, Shropshire, you know, also into Wales, that's where there are still the salt mines, and we still buy our salt from that Middlewich, Northwich, which obviously meaning W-I-C-H, meaning the saltiness. So
yes,
yeah, I think being able to stand behind your cheese and discuss it and communicate it with other people, it really resonates, doesn't it? Being able to say, well, you know, this is from this area, so therefore it tastes like this because of the way that we farm. And I think agriculture is, you know, it's changed over the centuries, but being able to taste that sense of place for me is really, really important. It's something that we really did it, you know, made these changes on purpose. A, because I'm an organic dairy farmer's daughter and I can't stand the fact that grass is growing. And I think cows should be out grazing. And you know, it makes, milk is a wonderful, wonderful product. And the fact that we don't send all of ours away in a tanker, you know, we bring it round and put it in the vat in the farmhouse dairy is absolutely joyous.
Yeah, that's a very wonderful, you know, that sort of magic. I mean, I had, I talked to Joe Schneider, who makes Ditchelton cheese, and he painted this, you know, this very eloquent picture of, you know, looking at, you know, the grass that the cow he sees from his window, that it, the, you know, that it's eating the grass. That is the milk that he's working with, you know, the next, you know, the next day. I mean, it's like this, this
it's
wonderful.
A privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an absolute privilege. And I hear, because Paul was much more on the farm until recently, and our cheesemaker, Gary, retired last Christmas, which was, yeah, really, he'd had a wonderful, wonderful time since he was 26, cheesemaker here. So
amazing.
Really learnt his craft with grandma as well. And having that, then that relationship with Paul and I, and making so many changes to the way we farm, he really had this wonderful swan song where things came together. And I remember him saying, you know, this really feels like it did when he started, what,
that's lovely,
years,
isn't it?
50 years or so.
In terms of the milk, he could see, obviously he was making the cheese, so he could see that these changes reflected. Isn't that interesting? Gosh,
the changes and the conversations. And I think, you know, for Paul, he was, when this happened in the, you know, the pandemic and everything was, you know, everything was slightly different. The Paul was milking the cows and making the cheese. And he said, what a wonderful thing to do. The way that you've seen, you know, you've walked the cows out in the morning and you see which paddock they are and you are touching that grass and then, you know, they come into milk and then you bring that milk round and you make the cheese from it and you put the cheese in the storeroom. And yeah, it is really poetic, isn't it? And there's a lot of craft, but there is also something really lovely about it. And I would agree with Joe, you know, I'm sat here and I can look out and see the fields and see the cows grazing, and it gives it a sense of purpose and a sense of space, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's lovely. I mean, it's very interesting hearing how much it means, isn't it? And this sort of, you know, and cheese making is hard work. But then the satisfactions that it offers too. So perhaps you should talk us through, you know, it'd be really interesting to hear a little bit about how, so using raw, it's a raw milk. One of the definitions of farmhouse cheese is that it's, you know, A, to start with, it's made on a farm, but by farmers using their own milk, that's very important. And using their own raw milk is also very central to that. I think that's something that's very precious to you, is it using unpasteurised milk?
Yeah, I think, you know, once you've put so much is invested into that, looking at the soil structure and the worm counts and you know, the grass seeds that we're sowing, and it's difficult, isn't it, the milk, because there's other pressures, aren't there? The TB, I don't know.
That's a big worry, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a big worry, and we are due our test next month, and although we wouldn't ever not want to make raw milk cheese, because I think, you know, the just the flavour is so delicious without having to have a process through which the milk passes before it goes into the vat to make the cheese, that we can't perhaps be so rose-tinted glasses that sometimes there are outside pressures that mean that we have to be a bit resilient and think outside the box and you know, at some point, each of us raw milk cheesemakers have faced that awful spectre of TB, and you know, and I think that's the wonderful, really wonderful thing about the specialist cheesemakers, whether we're farmhouse buying in milk, pasteurising, that we are all such a great collaborative team, that being able to pick up the phone and speak to someone who's been there and, you know, can know how upsetting it is to put everything invested into that milk to then have to pasteurise or have a challenge is really wonderful. But yeah, for us, for as long as we can keep it raw milk, then absolutely, there's never been any there's never been any discussion actually about
right.
Perhaps we should. But there we are. That might be something down the line.
Yes, I mean that the threat from TV, it is serious, isn't it? I think it's good for people to realise the actual difficulties in a way of trying to of making cheese and of farming. Yeah. You know, they are considerable.
Being resilient.
Yes, that
the
word.
Farming it's a very, resilience.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and in fact, brilliant. So perhaps we should have a think about what are the with your milk, since given that you're on the farm and it doesn't have to travel, is that central to the cheese? You know, do you use it pretty soon after milking, or do you how does it work in terms of making Cheshire on your farm?
Yeah, so with the milk, we use a mix of morning milk and night milk.
Uh-huh.
They're quite different with the butterfat protein ratio, which is what we talk about, don't we? The cheese making, it sounds like some sort of amazing formula, doesn't it?
Why would it be different? Just explain to a label, why would it be different in the morning milk and the evening milk?
Because the cows are doing they're having a slightly different timetable to their day, I guess. They're on a, when they go out in the morning, they go out and they graze and they snooze and they mooch around and they wander over to the water trough, and we milk them at 5 o'clock in the morning and they come back in at about 2:30, 2:45. So yeah, they've spent quite a bit of time grazing, and then they go back out again after they've finished milking, but their evenings are slightly different. They go on in a fresh paddock and they graze all that off, but they'll spend more time snoozing. So yeah, the milk is different in the nighttime, because my husband will tell me off for this. He'll be like, no, I always think it's slightly richer overnight because they've had more time hanging out and less time eating. They may eat more delicious grass in the middle of the day.
Yes.
And therefore the milk is richer in the evening milking.
Is cheese made daily on the farm?
No, at the moment we make 3 to 4 days a week.
Right.
Which suits us grand. We make about 9 kilo cylindrical cheeses. Oh, this is radio, isn't it?
It is radio, yes. Can't see you. Are you showing the shape? I'll imagine it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, in a year, we make about 45 tons-ish of Cheshire cheese, which is a real sort of drop in the ocean. But
a delicious drop in the ocean, can I insert? Yeah, so yes. And so I was also wondering, given that you're working with the milk on your farm, making cheese throughout the year, do you see the differences between, is one of the things that you'd see a difference between, for example, spring milk and winter milk? Is that because the cows are being fed differently? Is that right?
Definitely. And that was one of our real, not challenges, but discussions with the likes of Lovey David and Bronwyn at Neil's Yard and Paxton Whitfield, and, you know, with our customers, that when we made all these changes, we also made changes to our calving pattern.
Oh,
so there's a lot of dairy farmers that will calve all year round. There's a lot that will spring calve. There's a lot that will autumn. So we looked at our grazing platform. We looked at our herd. I'm a really big fan of talking to people and using mentors, and just, you know, there's constantly things to find out and think, will that suit my cheese? Will that suit my cows? Will it suit the family? I think that's one of the lovely things about being farmers and cheesemakers, those constant sort of discussions. But then we moved our cows around into an autumn block. So they start calving in August. And what I really love about it is they calve outside. So they're on standing hay. They calve outside. It's all really lovely. And just a nice environment for the cow to have her calve and then come into the milking herd. And we then obviously have milk then that is a mix of late lactation and then early lactation. So because our milking herd carving block is from August right through till Christmas. Mm-hmm. We sort of, it's designed so that we get what used to be called, if you go back and look in the beautiful old British sort of territorial cheese notelets, that, mm-hmm. that they were called early, mid and late ripening cheeses. So that was, I'm pretty sure, related to the cow's lactation. So the milk obviously hugely varies during lactation. So it's really interesting it coming into the vat. And that's when it's a discussion about, do we farm for cheesemaking, or is the cheesemaking just an offshoot of the farming? And for us, I don't think it fits into either. It's just part of a huge tapestry that works. I feel like we don't try and pigeonhole too much of either. Uh-huh. Does that make sense, Jenny?
So it's quite holistic in a way, isn't it? It's a bigger
system. Yeah. You know, the cows in a way have to. We don't have a different farm they can go and graze. So if the paddocks are a bit dandelion-y or something, that's almost our job in the cheese dairy to weave our magic and make it into a cheese that's still delicious. You know, but equally sometimes we're like, hang on, this cheese, perhaps we need to look at having a little bit more night milk and less morning milk, or you know, changing those ratios rather than changing the whole of the way that we feed our cows. Or
there must be lots of different things really you can tweak.
Yeah,
I mean, I always get whenever I talk to, you know, to a cheesemaker, they just need to say mini variables. So it's where do you start?
The variables are brilliant, but also many and multifaceted.
Yes, and it's so interacting, aren't they? So your cheese, and then perhaps we should talk about, you know, perhaps you described as though somebody, people must be listening to this, perhaps who haven't tried a Cheshire cheese, or perhaps haven't tried Appleby's Cheshire cheese, because there is a difference between, you know, industrially produced cheese and cheese made on a smaller scale in terms of the milk, in terms of the production, in terms of method. So you've made these beautiful cheeses using the milk from your cows. Do you mature them on the farm, or do they get sent off to cheesemongers who then take them on?
So once they've come, you know, out of the vat and into their moulds, and they go into the press room, which are all the sort of turn of the century hand presses, and they're pressed overnight, we wrap them in calico cloth to allow the cheese to breathe, which I think is again, you just touched on the more industrial types of British territorial cheese. And I think that's a really big difference, that we don't wax it or put it in plastic. Mm. That allowing the cheese to breathe. And I was just looking this morning, there's a cheese that's a couple of days old, that because the weather's been lovely and warm, it's grown this huge whiskery mould that's an inch and a half long. It is beautiful. It's like a sea anemone. You know, as I open the door, it's sort of wafting.
Waving.
It's
lovely.
Absolutely glorious. Yeah. So allowing the moisture to come out and the flora and fauna of our storerooms to go in. So yes, the cheeses are wheeled round on a trolley into our storerooms, which in fact both of them, because we have two that connect to each other, they were both parlours. So one was, I think, the very first rotary parlour that Paul's grandparents put in, got a long, long time ago. We've since built another one just sort of a little bit further towards the cow sheds. But that then connects to a very old herringbone parlour that was the original. And that's all beautiful with the bricks and the timbers. And just the smell when you walk in is there's something really unique about it. I think that maturation part of the cheese is also really important, because it's very here. And I have definitely, we've taken our cheese to other customers, and I've tried the cheese that's been part of, you know, the Affiner Dan Samuel's yard. And it tastes, I'm like, oh gosh, this tastes of you. Which I love. I mean, Cheshire is a crumbly cheese, and it definitely absorbs its atmosphere. I think they're little time capsules, aren't they? And as you unwrap it, you get the soil and the grass and the milk, and you also get that sort of sense of place of where they were in the storeroom. So there's Napoleonic timbers in our storeroom in the yard. So there's a lot of history. There's a lot of there's a lot of atmosphere.
Is it eaten what about sort of 3 months? Is there an optimum peak age at which you would like your Cheshire cheese to be eaten?
Yeah. So again, a couple of years ago, we felt that we were putting so much into the milk that when the cheese was maturing for sort of six to eight months, it had lost that juicy, fresh, milky grassiness. So we brought the age profile a little bit younger. So at the moment we're sort of selling it 6 to 8 weeks ish, and then there are lots of customers that then like to mature it. And there's a funny time, so we talk about our Cheshire having a funny time, that sometimes it can throw its toys at the pram, and the acidity pitches, because there's a lot of lactic acid in cheese making, but particularly in Cheshire, so it slightly pitches, and then it tends to just beautifully mellow off and reach, sort of shrugging off a bit of a tight jacket after a day's work. You know, that sort of...
It's a nice analogy.
Unloosening a waistband and it sort of becomes a bit more relaxes. But I will never bore of that, because equally I quite like it when it's a bit punchy and a bit more zesty. But we're finding, because obviously we haven't long made these changes on the farm, so every day is a learning curve, and you know, each batch of cheese is like, oh wow, that's really interesting. So we look back on our notes, and it definitely changes throughout the year by season, by lactation, and definitely I think that's one of the joys, the nuances are to be celebrated.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. Sure, yeah. I mean, cheese is, it's sort of fascinating, isn't it? And hearing you talk about all these changes, Sarah, and it really brings it home. I mean, so in fact, just to end on a note, so, farmhouse cheese, you know, this is a family cheese, isn't it, for you? Because this is your family history, and, it's connecting back to Paul's grandparents and to what that would have connected back to what their families had done and made. And how do your children, are they interested in the cheese? Do they enjoy eating it? Is it, do they like watching the making of it? Do they play a part in that?
Yes. Oh my goodness. Yes. So, as I said before, when I was talking about grandma and the pram, wheeling from the kitchen to the dairy, I think because that is still our dairy, we haven't moved it. And I wonder whether we are one of the last farmhouse cheesemakers left that have that doorway between house and dairy. So it's in the same unit, it's, you know, it's on the same bricks and mortar, but the children love it. They call it channel cheese, so they'll lift and look through, obviously with Paul and I and our team, Tom and Corey in there, and the children, as they've grown older, have become more and more fascinated, I think, with the farming, and they're really helpful, and they really ask questions too, particularly our oldest children, why are you doing it like this? And for them, I think that generation is very used to communicating about the environmental issues of food production. We've eldest son is coppicing our trees, and we've planted a lot. I think they're very aware of their surroundings, and then they all have to be involved in the cheese making. They've all come in the dairy or patted the butter or helped me sell it, but mostly they enjoy sitting and eating it around the kitchen table with friends, or when Neil's yard come, and being able to sit and eat something that you've so involved in. It's such a part of your family, and also they're hungry. We've got 5 children and they can eat some cheese. So also there's always a block of you know, there's a good wedge of Cheshire always on the go, and quite often doesn't get put away through the day. It's just left out on the butcher's block. And also they love eating Joe's cheese, Graham's cheese, Jamie's cheese, Tim and Simon's cheese. So, you know, the stitch will take.
It's a wonderful world of cheese.
It's brilliant. It is brilliant.
Oh, Sarah, that's a wonderful image. I love that of, you know, of this cheese at the heart, you know, on the farm where it's made and being enjoyed. That's wonderful. So thank you so much, because I know how busy you must be. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. That was lovely, Sarah. Thank you.
Oh, no worries, Jenny. Thank you.
Take care then. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too. Bye. Bye-bye.
I'm a huge fan of Peter's Yard's crackers, and they go beautifully with cheese. All Peter's Yard's crackers are made in small batches, using quality natural ingredients and their sourdough starter, slowly fermented for 16 hours for award-winning flavour and crunch. Visit petersyard.com/shop, enter the code SLICEOFCHEESE at the checkout to receive 25% off your first order.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
Very happy to have with me on A Slice of Cheese, Andy Hatch of Uplands Cheese in Wisconsin. Hello, Andy.
Hello, Jenny.
Thank you so much, Andy, for taking time to join us. It's lovely to have you on this episode. We're exploring the idea this week of farmhouse cheese, which I think in America is farmstead cheese. And I very much wanted to ask you about the sort of story of Uplands Cheese. Tell me how that is a dairy farm. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And it's been a dairy farm for about 140 years, which is when this part of Wisconsin was settled, actually by some Cornish immigrants, as well as, you know, some Norwegians and Germans. And so they brought dairy cattle with them, and dairy farming has been kind of the mainstay of this part of the United States, in Wisconsin, and particularly our corner of Wisconsin since then. But this cheese in particular, this farm rather in particular, didn't start making its own cheese until the year 2000. So our history, relatively recent.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's interesting. And tell us, how did you become, because now you started working at the farm, is that right, yourself?
I did, yes. This is not my family's farm. I grew up in the area, but started working here when I got out of university for dairy science. In Wisconsin, to become a cheesemaker, have to serve apprenticeships, take classes, ultimately take a test. And anyway, this was the last apprenticeship I served in my early 20s and just never left.
Stayed. Yeah, brilliant.
Yes.
That's so interesting. So you just said, that's such fascinating what you just told me. So Wisconsin, you have to study dairy making in order to be a cheesemaker. Is that right?
That's right. It's the only state in the country that requires that. And it came with our immigrants. You know, I think the Central Europeans, you know, that model of an apprentice and a journeyman and a master. And that, we've held on to that here. And in fact, I'm now in the early stages of trying to become a master cheesemaker, which takes a number of years and, again, requires classwork and oral examinations, written examinations, et cetera. So it's a point of pride for the state. It's also, you know, you could say a bit of a protection of quality. You can't just, you know, put a vat into your garage and fire it up.
That's so interesting. In fact, funny, because I've been making another episode. It's about cheese education. And in Britain, we have the Academy of Cheese, which sort of studies cheese. And we have the School of Artisan Food, which runs cheese making courses. I mean, the impression I get when I talk to people in Britain is that it was very hard to access cheese making knowledge. You know, a lot of it is done by informally, in a way, I suppose, by going around and working, you know, quite sensibly with other cheesemakers and learning and watching, you know, a bit like, I suppose, like a stage for chefs, you know. So interesting that it was very structured. So did you get the cheese-making bug? I mean, did you set out thinking you'd want to be a cheesemaker when you studied dairy?
Actually, no. I set out thinking that I wanted to milk cows. And working towards that, stumbled into cheesemaking, and which was lucky because I think, like a lot of farms now, I would have really struggled to support a family selling, you know, commodity fluid milk. And so cheese sort of changes the financial dimension of dairy farming. But also it gave me something that I was, I think, well-suited to just temperamentally. And it also gave me a very rich life that I wouldn't have expected. The ability to travel, to get into cities and meet different kinds of people is something that a lot of farmers don't have. And I didn't see that at the start, but that's been a big blessing.
That's very interesting, because actually, I don't know if you know, there's a cheese in Britain called Baron Bigord, made by Johnny Crickmore and Fen Farm Dairy, which is like a British brie. He makes it from, Johnny was a dairy farming background. It's made from raw milk.
Yes, and it's a beautiful
cheese. Do you know Johnny?
Yes.
And Johnny said to me the same, because in fact I had interviewed him, and he said, Jenny, my life's been so rich. Yeah, exactly that. He said, it's very interesting. He said he met this wonderful mix of people. You know, he could go to, you know, he might meet chefs. He might go to a show and, be talking to the public, selling, trying to sell his cheese. And just this, he just said, it's so different from being a farmer on your own in a farm. It's opened up this whole world for him.
Yes, and it makes it easier to learn. We're talking about cheese education. And one thing to, do it in a university setting, but of course, speaking to people from Britain, or, we sell our cheese in New York and Los Angeles. Just meeting people whose lives are different from yours makes you learn, as a person or as a business owner, and broadens your perspective. And as important as it is as a farmer to be intimate with, what you're doing, your land and your animals, it can create tunnel vision.
Ah, yes.
Out of habit, if nothing else. Dealing with the cheese market around the world helps snap you out of that.
Do you tell us more about the cheese, which is a very famous cheese, Pleasant Ridge? Tell us about that, Andy, and what give me that sense of the farm.
The appropriate way to understand Pleasant Ridge is to know that it is an extension of the way this farm was already being run, as opposed to, say, a cheesemaker coming up with a cheese and trying to create milk to suit that. Our farm is in the southern corner of Wisconsin, which, for thousands of years has been kind of what we call an oak savanna grassland. So big, gnarly oak trees every few hundred feet, and then miles and miles of hills and grass. So this farm, you could say, was sort of meant to graze cattle. Farmers that preceded me here had always produced all of their milk in the spring, summer, and fall with the cows only on fresh pasture. That produces milk, as any farmer knows, just drinking milk out of his bulk tank, that produces milk that tastes different. And it was in the 90s when these farmers started to ask themselves, well, how could we take advantage of the flavor of this summer grass-fed milk? And so they looked to old world traditions, cheesemaking traditions that had been built around grass-fed milk. And of course, mountainous regions all over the world, for hundreds of years, shepherds will take animals up into the mountains so they can make hay in the valley fields. And of course, cheesemaking then was just a way to preserve that milk from those mountain pastures. So they looked at those types of traditions and circled around cheeses from the French and Swiss Alps, Gruyere, Comté, Beaufort. Those cheeses historically had been made with that summer grass-fed milk. And so Pleasant Ridge was really our effort to borrow from that tradition, to make a style of cheese that is kind of meant to show off the flavor profile of grass-fed milk.
We're talking in late April, so are you about to hit sort of this is late spring? Is this when it starts to become very busy? Is this the time when you will start making cheese?
Yes. In fact, it's noon here on a Friday. If we had pushed this talk off another week, I'm not sure I could have done it.
We're very lucky to have got you. Yeah, wonderful. Just
so
in time.
I'm sitting here in the farmhouse, looking out the window. Our cows are out on the fields now, and most of them have calved. We are our whole herd calves in the spring in time for the growth of the pastures.
Right.
And it's green, but it's unusually cold. We're several weeks behind. The last several years, we would have already been making cheese by now, but I think we're still a week out. So we won't even start making Pleasant Ridge until the cows are on a pasture diet. So they're out in the field now, and we're supplementing their diet with hay. And as the grass starts to grow here over the next week, they'll eat less hay, more grass, less hay, more pasture, rather. And eventually they'll just ignore the hay altogether, be on an all-pasture diet, and that's when we start making cheese. So we kind of let the cows and the weather guide that decision.
Right. And how big is your herd? How many cows do you have?
Yeah. We milk about 200 cows.
And is there a particular breed? I mean, have you chosen them for cheese making, or were these the cows, the dairy cows that were on the farm already? I mean, you know, the breed.
It's an unusual herd of cows, actually. It's the combination of, over the years, 8 or 9 different breeds. And we are still crossbreeding with the goal, really, of developing cows that work for our particular farm, which is rather unusual. Our cows are outside 365 days a year.
Wow.
So in the heat of the summer and in the cold in the winter when they're not being milked. So there's a ruggedness and an athleticism we need in our cows that most cows living in a barn wouldn't need. So there's certain physical traits we're looking for, and then also certain milk characteristics that are tailored to the requirements of the two cheeses we make. And so by combining different breeds, you know, you'll get cows that are unusual, different combinations of the traits of these breeds. But when you find daughters that have the combined set of traits you want, when you find these cows, you continually save daughters over generations, get more and more of the cows you want.
That's fascinating.
So this crossbreeding predates me on this farm. It goes back over 30 years. And so we've just had about 200 calves in the last 6 weeks. And it's exciting to, you know, see another generation and pick daughters from your favorite cows and watch it keep going. It sounds all, you know, tidy and dialed in, but like any genetics, it's an imperfect science.
Yeah.
But we have a pretty special herd of cows.
I was just thinking how fascinating it is, because if you're breeding your own, if you're crossbreeding cows, that makes your cheese even more unique then, doesn't it? Because then in a way, if these are breeds that you're, you know, you're breeding these cows for the traits that you want for your farm, then it's very much an expression. So it's not just the land that they're grazing on. It's also the animals. Isn't that interesting? That are sort of unique to you in a way, I suppose.
Yes. No. That's. I think you've touched on the two most important ways in which we try to create a cheese that's distinctive. You know, it is number one, an unusual herd of cows based on our own kind of novel genetics. And then number two, you know, we only make this cheese while the cows are eating our fresh pastures. So both of these conditions, the pastures and the cows, couldn't be found anywhere else. And it's not to say that, you know, we're better than anybody else making farmstead cheese, but it is to say that the cheese coming off this farm can't be made elsewhere. And that really, it has a certain romantic appeal. I won't deny that. But also just as a competitive business strategy, it's appealing because it means we're making something unique. Rather than making a generic product, we'd have to bring to market and compete with other producers, say of cheddar, based on, you know, price, marketing budget, et cetera. We sort of try to remain in a category of one.
Right. Well, yes, which you are. That's, isn't that interesting? I mean, that's very powerful. I come across that in the world of, you know, that the importance of place in cheese, and for artisan cheesemakers who are, your cheeses are raw milk. Am I right in saying that?
It is, yes. And
yeah,
that is also absolutely key to transmitting the character of the land and animals to the cheese.
That's so fascinating. We were talking to, I was talking to Bronwyn Percival about microbes in cheese, you know, and the richness of the, you know, the microbial possibilities within raw milk, you know, that hasn't been heat treated. So you've just got, you know, you've got a lot more microbes there. You've got a lot more potential in a way, haven't you? It's something which a lot, it's very, very fascinating. So tell us more about Pleasant Ridge. Describe, so you've sort of talked about this mountain, being influenced by this mountain style. So what does it look like and what's the sort of size? And I'm afraid I haven't tried it, which I'm very rueful about. What? Tell me about it.
Oh, we will fix that, Jenny.
Thank you. Oh, thank you, Andy.
Well, it is made in the style of classic Alp cheeses, Beaufort and Gruyere, and that the curd is cooked and pressed and then ripened with a natural washed rind. So the rind is washed in brine as it's aged. Our wheel is smaller, about 4 to 5 kilos. Most of these mountain cheeses from the Alps are, 20, 30, 40 kilos.
Yeah.
So it's a smaller wheel, and we make about 80 wheels a day throughout our grazing season, which is about 200 days of the year. So next week, we'll probably start making cheese. will do it for about 200 days in a row.
Gosh.
And make about 16,000 of these wheels that are tucked away into the ripening rooms here on our farm.
And lovely.
Will be sold the following year once they're aged about a year.
Oh, gosh, so it's a year. That's a long time, isn't it? Yes, you've tied up all your money for a year, but you've got last year's stock, presumably. Did you start making that cheese, Andy, or was that the cheese that was being made on the farm already? Oh, you said that the people, you know, cheese started making the farm in 2000.
Yes, making Pleasant Ridge when I arrived as an apprentice. They started in 2000. I arrived in 2007.
Right. Have you kept the same cheese, or has it changed? You know, in the years that you've been on the farm, have you tweaked it and worked with it?
Good question. The principles behind the cheese have not changed. You know, our own herd of cows, raw milk only when they're on fresh pasture, mm-hmm. you know, aged for about a year with a natural rind. But of course, as with any farm, season to season, the conditions change, the herd is continually evolving. So on a seasonal level, there's variation. And of course, with an aged raw milk cheese, particularly one where it's a single herd of cows that are being rotated daily through different pastures, that sort of situation will always yield, you know, variability batch to batch, almost like different vintages of wine. So, you know, while our philosophical approach to making the cheese has not wavered, the cheese is of course always changing. Which if we were a big business trying to sell, you know, a homogenous product to a huge marketplace would be, you know, could drive you crazy. But for a small producer like us and for customers, especially who appreciate complexity and nuance and can accept the variability comes along with that, it actually makes for, I think, a more interesting product.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Because I'm a food writer, Andy, not a cheese writer, but I sort of fell in love with cheese through Neil's Yard Dairy in London, through initially as a customer, and then through my writing, I got to, you know, interview Randolph, and he's a wonderful man. And that one of the things I've always loved, you know, that Neil's Yard Dairy, they give you tastings of cheese, and I would, and it was like this revelation of like, actually, you know, I can go in and say, oh yes, I like to try the Montgomery's cheddar. And I sort of think, oh, I know what Montgomery's cheddar's like. And you think, oh no, actually I don't, because it tastes different batch to batch. And it was this sort of revelation as someone, you know, who, you know, I'm not a cheese maker. I'm someone who's buying and eating cheese and enjoying it. And you think, and this is as you said, it's this, you know, it's very exciting, isn't it? When you realise that this food changes, you know, and it's been made with great skill and care, but it's not going to be consistent and, you know, it's not going to be repetitive. It's going to be like, yes. Oh, I do want to try it because today, oh, it's like this. It's, you know, it's particularly Marmite-y, or it's got, you know, a different note to it, or the texture's slightly different. It's that sort of fun of what's it going to be like? I don't know. It's fun. Yeah.
Yes. And it's something to celebrate. At Neil's Yard, more than anyone else in the English speaking world, has, you know, kind of taught us how to think and talk about cheese in that way. I worked there for a spell, actually. It was very influential for me.
In the Covent Garden shop or the Borough shop? Or behind
both,
scenes?
As well as the Arches. And it actually, I started here in 2007 as an apprentice. So I was tucked back in the corner of the ripening rooms, you know, all by myself, turning wheels of cheese, as one does when you're the first year apprentice. And in walked Randolph, you know, on a tour of Wisconsin dairies. And, you know, Randolph was always good at kind of, you know, lingering off to the side, watching quietly, asking those sly questions. So he hung out next to me for a while. And he eventually said, well, you know, I understand you don't make cheese here in the winter. Like, what are you going to do? And, you know, like any 22-year-old, I was like, I don't know. And he said, well, why don't you come work for me?
Brilliant.
So when we finished the cheesemaking season here that first year in October, I went over and spent 6 months
in England. Yeah.
And it was eye-opening for me. I mean, the farm here had already been on its course with, you know, milking the herd seasonally on pasture, making Pleasant Ridge. For me to go to Neil's Yard and learn how they talked about cheese like this to their customers was revelatory for me. And it was also very interesting for me to taste cheese, you know, as a matter of course. These 70 cheeses they sell every day in the shop, they're all tasted and talked about. So it was a huge broadening of, you know, my exposure to the world of cheese. And so I owe a huge debt to not just to Neil's Yard, but there were a number of British cheesemakers who took me in for short stints.
And ah, brilliant.
I learned a lot.
There's a lot of generosity. It's one of the things I love about the British cheese scene. I don't know if it's you know, maybe not just the British, but that's the scene I know. But there's a sort of camaraderie among it, you know, and people are very generous about sharing knowledge, I feel, with each other and sort of and supporting each other through crises, of which, you know, there are lots. And I love that sort of, yeah, this sort of feeling, I don't know, of friendship in that world.
Yes, very much. And it's a defining characteristic, I think, of the cheese world, and not just Britain, certainly it feels similarly in the US. We send apprentices back and forth still.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a sense that, you know, as artisan cheesemakers or retailers, we don't so much compete with each other as we do with industrialized boring cheese.
And I think you're right.
The rising tide ought to lift all of our ships. You know, the more somebody is switched on to Montgomery's cheddar, I think the more apt they are to also buy my cheese.
That's a very good point. And that's very much how Randolph, I think, has always seen it. You know, like, just make people, you know, get people to understand and appreciate good food. And that's good for everyone who makes good food. You know, you're not in, you're not in competition with each other as food, as artisan cheesemakers. You're in competition with dull mass-produced cheese. And so, in fact, I wanted to ask you, Andy, I was interested. So this, you know, and your cheese is very, Pleasant Ridge is very acclaimed, isn't it? It's one that wins a lot of prizes and it's found a very appreciative audience. Do you think that, have other farmers in Wisconsin looked at what you've done and your story, the story of Pleasant Ridge, and been inspired by it? You know, is there a rippling effect, so to speak?
Yes. And in fact, our business, being about 22 years old, was part of a blossoming here in Wisconsin in the early 2000s. There are a handful of other similar businesses who started making farmstead cheese at about the same time. And so we're amongst the class of producers here who I think are credited with inspiring, if not themselves, transforming the dairy landscape, because there are a lot of large businesses here, you know, compared to whom we are awfully small. But we've, you know, I think changed perceptions about what's possible in the market. And, you know, the attention given to small production cheeses like us has, you know, galvanized a shift in the larger industry. So, and so that it's been a very exciting 20 years in that sense in Wisconsin. There has been a lot of growth of diversity and new products. Looking forward, you know, I think we need another blossoming or renaissance here. It's getting harder to start small companies.
Oh,
you know, the economic headwinds are worse than ever, and regulatory issues haven't made it easy. So there's some concern, I think, that it's not as easy as it once was for a farm to start making its own cheese. But
that's a shame, isn't
it? Yes. That's something we're talking about and you know, trying to improve.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, because I've been writing about food in Britain for decades, and I've seen that, you know, a sort of rise within Britain of cheese, of sort of craft cheese making, I suppose you call it, artisan cheese making. You know, people joining some of the older families and making interesting new cheeses, and interesting mix, I think, in Britain of the traditional cheese making. You know, people making, you know, cheddar or Lancashire or Cheshire, and then, you know, and then someone like Martin Gott making St. James, which, you know, which is always changes. You know, it's always just definitely St. James's cheese, but it's going to taste different every time, you know, which is sort of the fun. And Martin's very articulate about that, about that's one of the pleasures of his cheese, you know, that he's, yeah, exactly what, as we were saying. But it is interesting how, yes, what can be a lovely, exciting time can then fall away, I suppose. And what you need is that new, yeah, but you need opportunity, don't you? It's the economics of it. It's got to work for the farmer, hasn't it?
Yes. And what is the sentiment like in Britain now with small scale farm businesses? Is everybody still riding out the shock of the pandemic, or is it?
Yeah.
Can you tell? Is there optimism, or
it's? I don't think optimism. I think actually, funny enough, because COVID hit cheesemakers terribly, and actually one of the things I did very early on in the first few weeks of the pandemic was I sort of really, we're all stuck at home, you know, not allowed to go out. It was in lockdown. And I saw things like sort of Johnny selling his Baron Bigod at half price. And I was like, what's happening? And I got on the phone to a lot of people I know, you know, Neil's Yard Dairy and cheesemakers like Graham Kirkham, and realised it was disastrous, you know, because, there was no export, there was no wholesale, there were no restaurants. So they were left with cheeses, perishable cheeses, you know, trying to sell them. And I wrote a piece commissioned myself to write an article and put it on my website, British Cheese Crisis. And it sort of went viral and helped. Oh, did you see it, Andy?
Yes.
And actually that was like a running call. And I just literally, like, if you want to help, you know, buy cheese, you know, support cheesemongers and cheesemakers, you need both, you know, they both need each other. You know, we need the cheese shops to come through this. So that was quite a shock. And I think then I sort of went back and caught up with cheesemakers, and they all said to me, we've really diversified what we do. You know, Graham Kirkham has got a farm shop. I think they're just trying to, like, not put all your eggs into one basket. You know, don't rely just on wholesale. Have a retail outlet as well. You know, just try and be more, I suppose, have more resilience built in your system where you can. But of course, we've also had Brexit, and that changes the whole what's going to happen to farming. And there's a lot of, you know, it's like, what will happen? We don't know. It's all a bit vague at the moment from the government. So I think farmers are in quite an anxious place, actually, I would say.
Yes, that's the sense I've gotten. It's not gotten any easier, for sure. I think the article you wrote had reverberations over here, even. I think the New Yorker cited it. They wrote how a cheese goes extinct or something.
Yes, that's right. Yes, and I was credited. Yeah, I'd done this sort of, you know, because it was from... Yeah, it was from the heart, that piece I wrote. I actually had tears in my eyes. You know, it was very moving. These are people I'd talked to over the years, and it was always been very joyful. Like, you know, how do you make your cheese? All lovely, you know, tell me. And then I was talking to people, and you could hear the stress and the anxiety and the worry. You know, how do I keep growing? Graham Kirkham's saying to me, how do I, you know, normally I sell 120 cheeses a week. I sold 9, you know, Jenny, how do I keep my farm, my family, my dairy? Get on 9 cheeses. You know, it was a disaster. So I wanted to write as powerful a piece as I could, you know, and do justice to it. And it was amazing. What was wonderful, Andy, which I think really touched cheesemakers in Britain, was that there was such an outpouring of love for cheese from the British public. And my social media feed was just for weeks on Twitter, which is people telling me they'd read my piece, bought cheese. Then they tell me it's arrived. And everyone who contacted me, I replied saying, thank you so much, you know, and enjoy your cheese. And it was just amazing. And and I think a lot of people discovered that actually they do. And the cheesemakers, I think it was Joe Schneider, said to me, it just really mattered to us to know that people cared, you know, as well as the financial thing. It was actually the emotional thing of knowing it matters to people what we do. That's pretty powerful.
And I haven't spoken to Joe in 2 years, but from this distance, it looks like he had opened up online sales, and that was a big deal for them.
Yeah, it was, because they had to. Yeah, a lot of, you know, you can now buy. I mean, that's what's quite interesting, is that really that online, the chance now to try and to buy cheese directly from producers is really interesting, from cheesemakers who before didn't. Is that something that you do, Andy, or do you have you got sort of route to market in different ways that you?
Yes, we do sell through our website, and we've had in general a similar reaction to the one you described with the British cheesemakers, that we were sort of compelled to diversify and now see that as an appealing strategy. So we always had website sales. They were pretty incidental, but they became a much more important part of the big picture in 2020 and 2021. And now, you know, we'd like to keep that going.
Yeah.
We're contemplating opening a farm shop, which is something we've never had.
The Graham Kirkham did that, and he found it. He's really enjoyed it, I think. And this is the other thing is, of course, he can support other cheesemakers, because he's selling not just his cheese, but other cheeses. It's very interesting for me watching the cheesemakers sort of, you know, become cheesemongers in a way as well. It's,
all of us awkward introverts all of a sudden have to become, you know, extroverts and engage with the public. But it's something we're talking about a lot here. And I made the point early on that it's, you know, having a cheese business as a farmer, you know, leads to a richer life. You're out engaging with people. And so, you know, we're trying to think through here now. Well, do we want to, does that also mean that really engaging to more directly with the public, bringing people onto your farm, is that going to be a good thing? Is that going to, you know, improve the quality of our lives? Is it going to drive us crazy? You know, what will it bring to our farm to really start to welcome the public here? And, you know, part of me thinks that, and I'm not the only one, obviously, that it, it is kind of the next important frontier for particularly farmstead cheese making, is to really show people what we're doing and to give them these kind of a peek behind the curtain at a real experience. And, you know, the argument goes, you know, the more we're all buying things on Amazon, the more rare these experiences become where you actually touch something, buy it from the person who makes it. And so, you know, here we would call it agritourism. You've got a certain degree of it in Britain, of course, and it's not a new concept, but it's
big in Italy. They have, I mean, it's very interesting. Yes, how do you know? There's been a lot of pressure on farmers to diversify, and of course, adding value to milk by tinned cheese is a very old thing, isn't it? An ancient thing, an ancient way for, you know, to change, to add value to milk in that way. But I think you're right, isn't it? Because firstly, we're in a world that's very disconnected from food production. And I think lots of people just don't realise quite how much hard work. It's one of the things, like, it's a repeated sort of refrain on this series of podcasts, is like the hard work and the care. It's one of the things I've wanted to do through my interviews with cheesemakers, is to let people understand, you know, that there's an awful lot, especially when it's your own milk, you know, you've got the care for the animals, you know, the care for the farm, for the pasture, you know, that's, and the cheese making and the care that goes into the cheese. So that's just, that's a lot of work, isn't it?
Oh, endless. You can't even really call it work, or you would, the thought would overwhelm you. It needs to be something you commit, you know, your life to.
Wonderful.
Essentially.
Yeah. I was going to ask, Andy, I wanted, because you said you mature Pleasant Ridge for a year. And is there a moment then, and we talked about the variabilities, you know, within it because of the what the cows are feeding on and the changes. So when you taste it, do you have a sort of, is there a lovely moment when you would go in and taste a batch? And then is there a thrill when you think, oh, you know, I love this batch made, you know, I don't know, in May or in June when the grass was, you know, particularly full of clover or whatever it is. This is tasting wonderful. Do you get these satisfactions then when after all that patient waiting?
Yes, and it's satisfaction at times, it's joy at times, it's concern. I mean, I have young children, and it's been really interesting to, as I raise children, realize how similar it is to, you know, aging cheese. So, you know, there are moments of pride and moments where
despair. You know,
you have trouble falling asleep at night. Yes. Yes. So, so tasting our cheese is, yes, it's probably the most gratifying part of what we do. I have a love of the physical work. And so in the summer, milking cows and making cheese every day, you've got to enjoy, you know, working hard, you know, being exhausting yourself. There's a sport-like satisfaction in that. But of course, you're making cheese every day. You tuck it away into the cheese caves, and we won't taste it for 6-7 months after we've made it. So then once we stop making cheese in the fall, in the winter, everything slows way down. And that's kind of when we spend the most time in the caves tasting cheese. And It's a little bit like watching your child ride a bicycle for the first time, or it's you sort of see what you have wrought, and it's very satisfying and but sometimes confounding, and particularly with, you know, a cheese like ours, like I've said, raw milk, single herd, you know, rotationally grazed through pasture. There's variability, so it feels as much of like a discovery as it does a measurement of something you manufactured.
It's interesting. Yes.
There are surprises.
That's excitement. Always. Yes. Yes. Mm. Which is, wonderful. Oh, listen, Andy, I've taken up so much of your time, but it's been so fascinating to talk to you. Thank you. I really appreciate you. Thank you for coming on.
You're very welcome, Jenny. Happy to.
Lovely. Take care, Andy. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Thank you so much for listening to A Slice of Cheese. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, it would be lovely if you could rate us on wherever you've found this podcast. It will make such a difference to us. So I hope you'll enjoy us again. Thank you very much.